It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's a cult wine man. San Francisco wine merchant and importer Kermit Lynch backed into the wine world and ended up being a leader in the little known and exquisite. He even braved the wine merchant's kiss of death, rosé. Well, he has a new book of his adventures. It's called Inspiring Thirst. Well, the Sterns are into luscious but elusive in Chattanooga. Wine maven Joshua Wesson cracks the code for teaming booze with stews. Steve Jenkins talks cheese on the cheap, but without compromise. And British writer Nigel Slater remembers a mother straining to cook with love, but always missing the mark. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today we talk dream jobs with one of the wine world's cult figures. Kermit Lynch is a San Francisco wine merchant and importer. His new book is Inspiring Thirst, Vintage Selections from the Kermit Lynch Wine Brochures. Wine maverick Joshua Wesson has the tricks to matching up sipping with those simmering pots of winter stews. Cheesemonger Steve Jenkins has tracked down the world-class cheeses with the best price-quality ratios. British writer Nigel Slater remembers his mother's doomed attempts at bringing love to the dinner table. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, are you guys going to be heading south soon?
We always love to head south. And when we are heading south, one of our all-time favorite places to stop is Chattanooga, Tennessee. Because there's a place in Chattanooga that no one would ever accidentally find. It's open exactly 15 hours a week, lunch only, Monday through Friday. It is not listed in the yellow pages under restaurants. It is listed in the white pages under the name of the owner's mother-in-law. So unless you know about this restaurant, you're never going to find it. But it is well worth going to because it has some of the best meat and three lunches you'll find anywhere in the South.
And what is the name?
The name is Zarzur's, named after Charlie Zarzur, the man who founded it in 1918. It's still run by his family.
So you better explain what Meat and Three is about.
Meat and Three means you get a menu that lists maybe two or three meat items and approximately a dozen different side dishes. And the side dishes tend to vary all the time because it's based on what the proprietor can get that morning at the market. You choose one meat item and three, or in this case, two side dishes, and that's your meal.
See, people think Alice Waters invented getting food that was of the season. But in fact, Meat and Three places like Zarzur's were doing it decades before. So, you know, when you order, you get a piece of fried chicken, and then you have your choice of candied yams or turnip greens or candied apples or if you're pigs like the Sterns are, you will get, you know, all 12 items with a little piece of fried chicken off to the side. One of my favorite things at Zarzur's, which is really a tongue twister to say, is this antediluvian, I think that's the right word, dish of baked spaghetti.
Ah, yes.
Have you ever had baked spaghetti? It's not in any of your cookbooks.
No.
I couldn't admit, but I've had like a baked spaghetti casserole. Is that what this is?
Yeah.
It's like an old tea room dish.
Yeah, like a nursery food or something.
And what's so great about it is the textures, because, you know, al dente is never heard of in this. I mean, from down deep in the casserole, very, very tender noodles. From the top and sides of the casserole, you get kind of crusty cheese-encrusted noodles. It's just a wonderful textural thing. It really is like baby food. I mean, it's comfort food supreme.
You know, and I just want to tell you a word about the customers who eat there. It is the most interesting cross-section of people because they're, you know, obviously real blue-collar guys with, you know, grease on their hands who come in for lunch. Mm-hmm. And they're sitting next to men in bespoke suits that look like they probably own the railroad. So it's very much like an in-crowd place in Chattanooga. And as Michael said, Chattanooga is not an easy place to find food that is, you know, is unique.
Well, what else is going on in Chattanooga? If you're going to go there to eat, what else would you be doing?
Well, if you're going to stay there, you can actually, you've heard of the Chattanooga Choo Choo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well,
You
can stay in a hotel that is called the Choo Choo Hilton. And instead of staying in an ordinary old hotel room, they actually put you up in an old kind of refurbished railroad car.
That sounds pretty snazzy.
Well, it is. It's kind of like having your own personal railroad car the way, you know, John D. Rockefeller did. But it's yours for the night, and the prices are fairly reasonable.
And you don't go anywhere. You wake up.
You hopefully wake up where you went to sleep. Yes.
And you wake up in Chattanooga.
And you build your entire life around the 15 hours a week this place is open.
Of Zarzor's.
Well worth doing.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Met the station at a quarter to three. On a train to Chattanooga, Tennessee. Trains are rolling on down the track. I'm going to Chattanooga and I ain't coming back, yeah.
Lynn Stearns are authors of that indispensable guide, Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And speaking of road food, we are hitting the road for Italy in April. We've organized a trip heading for my two favorite stomping grounds, Tuscany the Irresistible and to Emilia-Romagna, the subject of my first book, The Splendid Table. Now, this is the region that Italians call the culinary capital of their country, which is why I picked to do a book about it in the first place. This is the only place in Italy that produces the country's three world-class foods. Only in Emilia-Romagna can you make Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese, Parma ham, and the true balsamic vinegar, the stuff that you sip like a liqueur. It's pretty amazing when you think all this excellence in one place. Well, you can do the trip too. You can find details on the Italian adventure on the website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is my favorite maverick. He's a wine expert who follows his own drummer. Now, Josh believes good wine can be had for little money. And since Josh cooks, he has this extra insight into which wine goes with what dish. Hey, Josh, good to have you back.
I'm glad to be back.
Josh, I was thinking of you the other night. I was making a stew for a party. And I started wondering, how do you deconstruct a stew to decide which wine to serve with it?
Usually through a sieve. Sort of pull it in there. And you...
One carrot, one onion. Yeah, okay.
There's the turnip. There's the parsnip. I think that you don't really need to get too deep into the stew to figure out what the basic taste of a given stew might be. And a lot of people who love wine and love food get spooked a bit when they see liquid coming into the mix. Whether it's a soup or a stew, they think perhaps it's a little bit too tough to match one liquid with another. But every stew, no matter whether it's based on beef or lamb or doesn't have any meat, has a basic taste which will stand out. And that taste will be the weather vane that sends you in this chilly time to the right wine. It's easy to match wines with stews.
Well, give me some examples.
Well, a lot of stews, I mean, you've got this braised liquid, and you've got meat, and you've got vegetables. You don't have to be too specific. If you're cooking with a big red wine in the mix, then it's probably a good idea to serve a big red wine. You don't need to use the same wine, mm-hmm. but big Cabernets and big Syrahs and Côte de Rhones and Châteauneuf du Pape are all great candidates for meaty, rich, red wine reduction-based stews. But if you're cooking with a white wine, or maybe you don't have any wine in the stew, the braising liquid's made of water and other savory things, then you can play fast and loose and do a red or a white.
So do you have some favorite picks?
Barrel-fermented Chardonnays. Some of the hardest wines in the world to pair with food go brilliantly with braised meat, when the meat hasn't been cooked beforehand. Mm-hmm. And it can be almost any barrel fermented or barrel-aged chard. I like Acacia. I think they make a lovely wine, and it sells for usually under $20. Just the straight Acacia Chardonnay is an excellent choice for stews like that. And Pinot Gris from Alsace. Not Pinot Grigio from Italy, which is too light to handle just about any kind of stew you'd throw at it, but a richer, fuller-bodied, sometimes even a little bit sweet, Alsatian Pinot Gris, and one of my favorites right now is from Schlumberger, and it's about $15, and phenomenal with lamb stews that are made with white wine, or Irish stew, or any deep dish that doesn't have red wine in the cooking process.
How about something very spicy? Because, for instance, curries are stews. What would you do in that case?
Well, I think that if you're going to have a fair amount of spice in the dish, it's wise to find a fair amount of spice in the wine, common sense.
Right.
And spicy wines can be made from a number of different red grapes in particular. Shiraz is a known commodity of spiciness. I like Syrahs and Shirazes with those kinds of dishes. But I also like Grenache because it has an element of spice with a little higher note of fruit in it. It's like somebody giving you a ping of cherries or plums on top of the spice. And you get two for the price of one when you get Grenache. But, here's the answer. Get a Shiraz Grenache blend. Why didn't I think of this before? I'm slapping my head here.
That's great. Okay, two grapes. So, Josh, what about some specific red picks?
Well, if we're talking about something a little spicy, Shiraz or a Shiraz Grenache blend, like the Punter's Corner, it's an Australian Coonawarra wine, goes for about $25, but it's worth every penny because every drop is filled with this delicious, warm set of flavors that roll over you, and it's almost like a meal in itself, but it's brilliant with rich stews. And Cabernet Sauvignon. Everybody thinks of Cabernet Sauvignon coming from Bordeaux, maybe from California. One of the great sources of stew-loving cabs happens to be south of the border, down in Chile. And the Montes folks make a wonderful Cabernet called Alpha, which sells for around $20. And it's got these deep, raisiny, plummy, toasted nut flavors, which can hang on to any red meat stew that has that deep brown flavor in there. It's just a phenomenal wine.
Mm. Booze for stews. Hey, Josh, thank you.
My pleasure.
Wine Authority Joshua Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can get Josh's wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. But to put that stewing advice to good use, I have got a winter stew for you from my favorite part of Italy, Emilia-Romagna. And it uses one of my favorite cuts of pork. It's country ribs simmered in wine, tomato, and herbs. Now, find the recipe, Emilia-Romagna braised pork ribs, on the website. splendidtable.org. Oh, and one other thing to check out on the site, our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. Now, every week we send you a new quick recipe. We send along shopping and technique tips. And best of all, it's free. You can register for it online, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Inspiring Thirst with wine importer Kermit Lynch, great cheese on a budget, and love doesn't always work in the kitchen. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at target.com/supertarget. Inspiring Thirst is a new book by Kermit Lynch. It's a collection of his wine newsletters from 1972 to now, but it's really a diary of a dream job. Lynch is one of those importers and wine merchants whose name on a bottle is like a secret handshake. Those in the know that they're going to be in on one of his personal finds. His name is often mentioned in hushed tones. So how does an importer work, and what does it take to become one? Kermit Lynch, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
So was this for you, like, always the dream to wander the world tasting great wines?
Not at all. It was accidental. I'm the accidental wine merchant.
How did it come about then?
I had another business, making ladies' handbags, sort of a craft business here in Berkeley.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it was called the Berkeley Bag. And somebody offered me money for it, of all things, because it was nothing more than a broken down sewing machine and a can of glue.
Very basic business, cottage industry. Okay.
So I took the money and went to Europe for 4 months, but not for wine. That was a part of my life, but that's not why I went to Europe. I just went to see it, to see what was going on. And when I came back, I needed a job. So I opened a wine shop, a small wine shop with about 30 cases for sale. And I just sort of followed my nose, and my nose took me back to Europe again and again, and,
mm-hmm.
and especially France and Italy, although at the beginning I was doing Germany and Spain too.
Now, you were well known for tracking down vineyards and winemakers that nobody had ever heard of. How did you find people?
Well, mainly in restaurants, you know, ordering bottles from people that I'd never heard of. I'd say mainly asking winemakers that were talented. You know, if I was in Burgundy, like I was at Jacques Cesse's at Domaine du Jacques, and he'd just started talking about, you know, who there was one winemaker that he thought was really great, who really deserved to be known, and it was Charles Joguet at Chinon. So I just took off the next day, went to Chinon, and that was it. I mean, sort of like a detective, you know, following leads. That's what it was like in those days.
Yeah. How was your French?
Oh, it was non-existent. really non-existent. I'd never studied it. I'd never spoken it. And all of a sudden, there I was in France having to buy wines. And the first purchase I remember, it was at Hubert de Monti's in Volnay.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you can taste, and you've got the repertoire of bon, you know, très bon, très, très bon. but once you start talking price, we needed a translator, so we went into Bonn and to the tourist office.
Right, yeah.
And found somebody there who spoke English, and he translated our transaction.
Bon, très
but, you
bon.
Know, you know, the French have this great saying that the best place to learn a language is on the pillow. And I found that to be true because I was seduced by a French woman from Beaune, a Burgundian family.
You chose and, well. I mean, you chose a great region.
And so she accompanied me on a lot of my buying trips, and that's how I really learned French. I usually say I learned in the cellars, but I'm delving further into my adventures on the wine route here.
Well, now, throughout the book, there is one winery that and a family that you talk about, Domaine Tompier. Who were these people? What was this about?
That, you know, actually, that wine was available at Chez Panisse in Berkeley before I imported it.
Uh-huh.
I have to say, Alice Waters and Jeremiah Tower discovered Domaine Tompier for the American market. But they were just buying it for Chez Panisse, and that's where I first tasted it. Then when I met Richard Olney at his place in Provence, he served it, and I fell in love with it. Then the next time I went to France, I went to Domaine Tompier and met the people and started importing the wine and selling it in my store and selling it to other restaurants and in other states. But the family, it was a big family. I think there were 7 kids, and the door was always open. You were always invited. Whether you were invited or not, they'd open the door to you, and you'd sit down to dinner, and of course, a lot of wine. And it was sort of more than learning to like their wine. It was like learning this lifestyle, this pleasures of the table and pleasures of wine and friends and. It's marked a lot of people.
A lot's been written about. It's the Perrault family, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lulu and Lucien, if I remember correctly.
That's it.
Yeah, and you say Lucien evidently had a big influence on your taste.
Well, he was a purist, and that's true. I remember he would he to serve him a wine, if there were any trickery or any vinification, you know, adding makeup to a wine or something, you know, to make it more attractive, Lucien rejected it immediately. He wanted that expression of the soil and the grape, and you know, that was
the essence of it for him.
That was the reality for him, and it rubbed off on me.
So Kermit, what was the wine that they made?
They made a red, which turned out to be fairly easy for people to understand because it's rather bold flavored.
Mm-hmm.
But they also made this beautiful rosé that just flowed whenever you were at the Domaine, or at Richard Olney's, or at Alice's place. So when I imported their rosé, I knew it was going to be rough, but it turned out to be practically impossible. Even with Alice behind it, and I was drinking it, and one of the big customers for it was the California winemaker Joseph Swan, who called it the best rosé in the world. It was difficult to sell 25 cases in 1 year because people didn't trust rosés. They would really look at me suspiciously, like, you know, I'd suggested some aberrant act or something, you know, to drink a rosé. And this all came from the California rosés of the day. The California rosés were sort of, that's where you put your, if you had rotten grapes, if you had some problems with humidity and some of your grapes rotted, you would make rosé out of it. But in France, Italy, Spain, as everybody knows, along the Mediterranean, rosé had a real purpose in life. And slowly, with a lot of help from Alice and Chez Panisse, because she really put the big bottles out of the Tampier rosé,
mm-hmm.
the first thing you saw sometimes when you walked into Chez Panisse. Finally now, we're allocated. We can't get enough of this stuff. 30 years later.
Kermit Lynch, thank you.
My pleasure.
I drive down an old dirt road just to see my lady. She lives in a dust-colored hood with a old baby.
Kermit Lynch is the author of Inspiring Thirst, and that music you hear is an example of Kermit's other passion, music. It's from his new CD, Quicksand Blues. Cheese expert Steve Jenkins is one of the pioneers. Decades ago, when even the fancy food shops were mostly carrying cheeses from semi-industrial producers, Steve was all over Europe and America stalking the artisans, the traditionalists, and the innovators. Steve is still at it. He's author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer and our source for all things dairy. Hey, Steve, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. Great to be with you.
Steve, where are the bargains in cheese? Where can I save some money?
Well, I was astounded when you mentioned this to me, and I began to think about it. And I've come across some of the greatest cheeses in the world are still extraordinary bargains. And most surprising of all, most of them are French.
Really?
Comté, huh. For instance, the great Gruyère de Comté from eastern France, from the Alps, is an extraordinary buy. It's as great a cheese to just put on the table and enjoy as a table cheese as it is one to shred and use for gratins and things. It's a super bargain. You'll find it in the marketplace for $7-$8 a pound.
What else?
The great blue cheeses from the Auvergne region. Blue d'Auvergne and Forme d'Ambert are amazingly inexpensive. I think we're getting $6 a pound for the blue d'Auvergne and just a little bit more for Forme d'Ambert, which is one of the... It's got to be one of the five greatest cheeses in all of France. Amazingly inexpensive. Same region, Saint-Nectaire, the great semi-soft cow's milk cheese from the Auvergne region. I can't believe how inexpensive it is. And of all the cheeses in the universe, Reblochon from Savoie has to rank as one of the top five cheeses in the whole world. Amazingly inexpensive. I can't understand why it's so inexpensive. It's got to be $7-$8 a pound every place.
You know, I want to ask you about how low can you go? Are there really good quality cheeses, let's say, around 5 or under a pound?
When you get to that, it's going to be Scandinavian stuff that's made by a factory, and they're using dead milk. And however much you want to try and fool yourself, they're not cheeses that are worthy of you, period. Uh-huh. You can't get a cheese that's worthy of you for $4 or $5 a pound. I don't consider American or Canadian cheddar to be worthy of you if it's $4 or $5 a pound. It means it's a 6 months age or a year age. It's not old enough. It is not a good choice. You got to spend at least $6, $7, $8, $9 a pound if you want to buy a decent cheese.
What about bargains from the United States?
There aren't any.
Really?
All the stuff that we're making in this country that I scream and yell about that's so fantastic is very expensive. Uh-huh. There's just no two ways about it. These are family farms that have not been rooted in the cheese heritage of Europe, the way they've done this for centuries, and they have it down to a science, their distribution channels. These are little family farms that are not making any money selling cheese. They're getting a lot of notoriety, and they're famous in their own locales, but they're sure as heck not buying boats or things, that's for sure. The cheeses from America that are worthy of our listeners are going to be expensive.
Uh-huh. So for the bargains, look to France mainly, or something.
Yeah, and Manchego from Spain, a cheese that I often say there's lots of better stuff you can get from Spain than Manchego, but Manchego's a superstar, and there's so much of it, you can buy really good Manchego for around $7, $8 a pound in lots of places.
Uh-huh. Hey, Steve, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Now, Steve is usually behind the cheese counter at Fairway Markets in New York City, but his cheap cheese picks are on the website, splendidtable.org. It's a terrible thing to have to do something every day that makes you feel like a failure. Something that you just don't have any instincts for, like cooking. Now, for some people, this is the trap of love, as in this short tale from columnist Nigel Slater.
My mother is buttering bread for England. The vigour with which she slathers soft yellow fat onto thinly sliced white pap is as near as she gets to the pleasure that is cooking for someone you love. Right now she has the bread knife in her hand and nothing can stop her. My mother's way of slicing and buttering has both an ease and an awkwardness about it. She spreads the butter onto the cut side of the loaf, then picks up the bread knife and takes off the buttered slice. She puts down the bread knife, picks up the butter knife, and again butters the freshly cut side of the loaf. She carries on like this till she has used 3/4 of the loaf. The strange thing is that none of us really eats much bread and butter. It's like some ritual of good housekeeping that my mother has to go through. It's as if her grandmother's dying words had been, always make sure they have enough bread and butter on the table. No one ever sees what she does with the slices we don't eat. I mention all the leftover bread and butter to Mrs. Butler, a kind, gentle woman whose daughter is in my class at school and whose back garden has a pond with newts and goldfish, crowns of rhubarb and rows of potatoes. A house that smells of apple crumble. Well, your mum could make bread and butter pudding, apple charlotte, eggy bread, or bread pudding, suggests Mrs. Butler. Or she could turn them into toasted cheese sandwiches. I love bread and butter pudding. I love its layers of sweet, quivering custard, juicy raisins, and puffed golden crust. I love the way it sings quietly in the oven, the way it wobbles on the spoon. You can't smell a hug, you can't hear a cuddle, but if you could, I reckon it would smell and sound of warm bread and butter pudding.
Nigel Slater's memoir is Toast, the story of a boy's hunger.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm. afraid you can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We have got Jennifer on the line calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Jennifer, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I have two questions. My first one is that when I have a robust, full-bodied red wine,
yeah,
I'm always perplexed as to some alternative food pairings to a nice, juicy filet, which I love, but I would love to have some new ideas. And then my second question is kind of related. I'm wondering if you are aware of any books out there that specifically address pairing. There's a lot of books with lots of great information, but they tend to lack information about pairing wines with specific foods or entrees.
Well, I'm going to answer the second question first.
Okay.
Because the first name that comes to mind is Andrea Immer, I-M-M-E-R.
Uh-huh.
She's done a couple of books. One of them is, I think it's called either Great Food, Great Wines or Great Wines, Great Food.
Okay.
And what I love about it is you think of the food, and I mean everything practically from popcorn and Twinkies, you know, to something very elaborate. And she's got a variety of wines to try with it at every price point.
Oh, great.
And it's really easy reference. You don't have to read 14 paragraphs to get the information.
Mm-hmm.
So Andrea Immer is one person to check out about that. And then big, robust red wines. Well, think about this way.
Mm-hmm.
What's big and lush and robust? Hamburgers, a lot cheaper than the filet, right? almost any beef stews, lamb stews. And anything that's made with red wine. So, for instance, if you have chicken that you've braised with red wine and mushrooms and onion and garlic, that would taste great with a big, lush red wine.
Okay.
There are also, for instance, certain pastas with meat sauces and lots of tomatoes. You know, big velvety red wines are dynamite.
Okay, great.
So that gives you the basic idea.
Yeah.
Don't worry about the color of the food. Worry about how lush and big is it.
Okay.
All right. And then that's how you match any wine with any food.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for a good question.
Thank you.
You take care.
Okay.
Bye. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the little known link between the food world's two pepper darlings, the Tillicherry peppercorn and the Malabar peppercorn? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be getting back to the phones in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what's the little-known link between the food world's two favorite peppercorns, the Tillicherry peppercorn and the Malabar peppercorn? Well, these two black peppercorns are the ones that food authorities always recommend. But although they taste slightly different, they come from the same plant. In fact, they're even picked at the same time. But the Tillicherry is bigger and riper because it gets more sun. Bigger and riper means bigger flavor, richer flavor. And this also means hand harvesting. You have got to pick that Tillicherry peppercorn from the end of a bunch of clusters. That end is where the sun reaches. Now, the Malabar is slightly less ripe and it's slightly smaller, but both of them outstrip your usual supermarket peppercorn by a country mile. By the way, this is what you learn when you have nothing to read in the waiting room except a spice merchant's catalog. Granted, my source is one of the most dependable in the business. Penzies. Okay, let's get back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who is up next? We have got Robert from Huntington, West Virginia. Hey, Robert, what do you want to talk about?
Liedergrund's cheese.
Oh, boy, the smelly stuff.
Yes. I haven't been able to find it for years, but I remember it from probably before your time, back about 49 or 1950.
Oh, really? Okay.
And the last time I saw it was at the Camelback Inn in Scottsdale, Arizona. It was on the menu, and it was primarily dessert cheese. That's where it was usually listed, under desserts.
Well, you know, very smelly cheeses like that are really, first of all, they're great savories at the end of a meal, but they're dynamite.
Yes.
With fruit. I mean, the contrast is great.
Oh, absolutely. That and a glass of crisp white wine.
Yeah, can't hurt.
That's right.
Well, I think it may be out of production only because, first of all, I have not seen it anywhere. And I haunt cheese counters, you know, when I travel, like on the coasts and everywhere else. And I seem to also remember something about it, reading some reference to it no longer being produced. Mm. If I were going to look for it, have you tried doing it on Google?
No.
Okay.
I don't have a computer.
You don't have a computer. All right. You know what I would do then? I would go to the library and I would check a recently published book on cheese. Now, I know our cheese guy that you hear on the show, Steve Jenkins, has done a book called Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer. And now that did come out several years ago, but I would leaf through that. The other thing is, would Limburger fill in?
No.
No. All right.
No.
Okay. Okay.
Liedergrund's is about five shades lighter than Limburger.
It is. Okay. Because it's been a long time for me. The other thing I would do is, I'm thinking of the big cheese operations that might carry the hard to find. Dean and DeLuca in New York City. The other place I would try in Ann Arbor, Michigan is Zingerman's. They handle a lot of cheeses. They do mail order and there is a store as well. And they carry a lot of hard to find stuff. Those are two places I can think of off the top of my head. I have to tell you, again, I don't remember tasting Liedergrund's. If I did, it was a long time ago. But what I do know is that German Munsters, not the Munster, not the, you know, the relatively mild stuff that we get, German Munsters that are really aged can have some of that wonderful, funky, overwhelming, but boy, is it good quality. And if you have a good cheese store near you, you might be able to find it or ask them to bring it in. So take a cup of coffee and head to the library.
Okay, fine. Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling.
I really enjoy your show.
Hey, thank you very much, Robert. You take care.
You too.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. We have Barry on the line calling from Los Angeles. Hey, Barry, what's up?
Hey there. Hi. I've been trying to make Indian fry bread.
Yeah.
And it's a very simple, very basic. It's flour, salt, little baking powder, and something for moisture.
Right.
And it's fried.
Are you running into problems with it?
I have been. They don't hold together. They fall apart, and they don't come out as crispy as we've had them.
Okay. You know, this is one of these things. The trickiest recipes are the simplest ones.
Uh-huh.
But with the Indian fry bread, when you say it falls apart, first of all, if you feel like it, you can invest in a deep fat frying thermometer.
And you find them at kitchen stores. You can find them at hardware stores. Because one of the real keys is you need to have your oil between 350 and 375. Because if it isn't that way, what happens is the stuff gets heavy, it gets greasy, it doesn't cook properly. But if for some reason you don't want to spend the money on that, one of the tricks that they used to use to tell if it was at the more or less the right temperature is you take a cube of bread and you drop it in the oil, and it should start to color and turn golden in something like 30 to 40 seconds. A minute, absolutely, at most. The idea is it should be gradually turning golden. If it takes much longer, the oil isn't hot enough. If it turns golden and starts to burn and it happens very fast, the oil's too hot.
Oh, thank you for your help.
You are welcome.
I'll keep trying it.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Take care. There's a whole key here to deep frying, guys, and it comes down to this. If it's something that has to cook for a while, all right, you do it at about 350. It's if it's something, you know, like a shrimp, a fritter or whatever, 375. And very rarely when you're doing things that are very, very thin and they cook really quickly, you might go up to about 395. But that's always the deep fat frying range, never below 350. Okay? Hey, you can call us 800-537-5252. We have Gia on the line from Hampton, Virginia. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, you are.
Oh, I can't believe it. I usually do not pronounce correctly, but what can I do for you?
Well, I grew up mostly with my grandparents living with us from about the age of 9, and my grandmother's people are from northern Italy, and my grandfather's folks were from Sicily.
Uh-huh.
And so there was a menagerie kind of cooking in our home, not quite southern, but not quite northern. And I have tried for years to replicate my grandmother's sauce, and over the years, of course, I can't get it right, but I remember her telling me that you never can saute onions and garlic, that the two flavors will cancel each other out. And I just need to know if this is just her way of going or if this is truly a culinary, you know, fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, I don't know that I agree with her about the two flavors canceling each other out. But if you heat oil in a pan, for argument's sake, and throw in the garlic and the onion at the same time, and the recipe has you cooking it until the onion begins to pick up color, I guarantee you will have burnt garlic.
Yes.
And burnt garlic is bitter and awful, and a lot of people say, I can't understand that my food tastes so bad, and I'm doing everything right, except that they burned the garlic, and the burnt garlic permeates everything. This is personal opinion. And you know, we all have myths we love to live with. Maybe we shouldn't call them myths. We have beliefs we love to live with that I think should never be tested because it's our preference, it's our taste, it's our own private credo. And your grandmother, obviously, she did not want that combination. And for me, I like the combination. I think garlic and onion enhance each other.
I do, too, and I've cooked with it, you know, despite her, you know, caution. And you're right, the burnt garlic, I have done that before when I wasn't paying attention, and, oh, it ruined the whole meal.
Right. And, you know, the trick with that is you get the onion where you want it, then you stir in the garlic and you cook it for a few moments, but, you know, and everything is fine. But this may be one of the keys to why that sauce tastes the way it does. I gather, did she not use garlic?
She used garlic, but it was mostly when we sautéed mushrooms or items
I see.
Her sauce was purely olive oil with sautéed onions and then the tomato products. Of course, everything, like I said, had her flavor, but my grandfather's strict Sicilian cooking instructions.
I would love to have been the fly on the wall in that kitchen.
Oh, yes, yes. When meatballs were made, it was a production.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the debates between North and South, this probably kept your family going for quite a while.
It has.
Anyway, that's my take. But this, as I said, this enters into family lore.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Call us, guys. 800-537-5252. We have Josie calling from Pandora, Texas. What a great name for a town.
It is. Thanks.
I love that. What do you want to talk about?
I would like to know what I could make with the tuna of a cactus. It's the prickly pear cactus pads in the summertime sprout these bulbs that are green, and when they ripen, they turn purple. and they look really yummy. And I want to try. I've actually bitten into one before, and they don't taste very good. But I'm sure that you could make something with them.
Is it the fruit of the cactus?
It's the fruit.
Oh yeah, there are different cactuses that give you different ones. What do yours taste like?
They don't really have a specific taste.
Uh-huh.
They are hard enough that you wouldn't. They look juicy because of the color. It's almost the color of a purple grape.
Right.
But it's the consistency of a radish or a potato.
Are they almost the flavor of like sour plums?
Perhaps. It's been a while since I tried it. I tried it once. I didn't try it twice.
Because I remember when I was in southern Italy, I found people were serving this fruit and making jam all the time out of something that they call, translated as figs of India. Mm-hmm. And what I learned was it was cactus fruit. And evidently different cactuses give different fruit. Sometimes it's really sweet and it tastes a little bit like a watermelon met up with a radish,
mm-hmm.
you know, as you described, that crunchiness, but it had a watermelon quality. You know, if these are kind, I mean, if they're attractive to eat to begin with, but to start, I would say they might really be a dynamite candidate to make like a sweet sour jam out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Cook them with sugar and maybe with a little chili, because the sour, the hot, and the sweet could be really fabulous together. And cook them until they're quite thick. And then what I would do is I freeze them. I don't think I'd try to jar them. Because you don't want to get involved in the sterilization and all that thing. But what I'm thinking is, wouldn't that be a fabulous thing to serve with roasted meats or poultry or fish?
Yeah. That's...
You know, as a counterpoint kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you make like a relish or a conserve out of them. So you throw in the chili, you maybe have a pinch of salt, fair amount of sugar, and you cook them away. And I guess the other thing you could do if they're really crunchy is pickle them and do like a sweet pickle thing with them, which might be really interesting.
Okay.
Okay?
All right, great.
See what happens. I think it's worth a shot.
Well, I'm going to give it a try. Thank you very much.
Okay. Hey, you take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
So you're a winemaker wannabe, but don't know where to start, or maybe you don't have the $100 million for your own vineyard. Michael Brill is in total sympathy with you. This San Francisco home winemaker has come up with a new idea for those who yearn to crush that grape. It's a crush company called Crush Pad. Hey, Michael, welcome.
Thank you.
So tell me, what is Crush Pad? What is this about?
So Crush Pad is a winery for individuals who want to make their own wine, their own high-end wine, but don't have their own vineyard and own winery and equipment. And so what we do is we bring that whole winemaking experience and the grapes and the expertise to urban locations like San Francisco and bring people in and enable them to make wine.
So how does it work?
So the customer is in control of every step of the process, really from grape selection to when we pick, how do we crush it and ferment it, and package design and getting it into the bottle. And we provide all of the facilities and the equipment and the winemaking expertise and the grapes to help them along that process.
So if I'm kind of clueless, but I think it's a great idea, you've got the people there to tell me how to do it?
Yeah, exactly. And we have, if you look at our customers, probably about two-thirds of them, actually about 90% of them actually have no direct winemaking experience. But everyone has a passion for wine and wants to learn more. So they come in really sort of wide-eyed about the possibilities of making wine with relatively little knowledge. And by the time they're done and the wine's in bottle, they are basically a winemaker.
Huh. So tell me, how much wine do you get out of this? I mean, is there like a minimum you have to commit to?
Yeah, so our focus is really, you know, ultra-premium and luxury class wine. So if you've got a passion for wine, if you're going to make wine, you're going to want to make the best wine that you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to make that style of wine, you really need to focus on barrel-sized lots. And barrels hold about 25 cases or 300 bottles.
That's a fair commitment.
It is. And I think that you know, for an individual, we actually have a lot of customers. Probably most of our customers are groups of people. So rather than one person taking away 25 cases, they'll team together with two or three or four other people and kind of experience that as a group. and then they'll end up with, you know, 4, 5, 6 cases of wine at the end of it.
So what does it cost, generally, to do 300 bottles of wine?
It varies, of course, depending upon the grapes and the oak. And with the weak U.S. dollar, a new French barrel is now $900 or more.
Uh-huh.
On the low end, it's, pricing is around $10 a bottle. It's like about $3,000 a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And for some of the higher end, like some of the ultra premium, say Napa Valley cabs, it can go up to, roughly $6,000 a barrel.
Great idea, Michael.
Thanks. It really is exciting. I think that when we started it, and this is our first year, in 2004, we didn't really know how much we were going to do and how much demand there would be. And we tripled or almost quadrupled the volume that we expected to do in 2004. And then based upon the response we've gotten already for 2005, it seems absurd, but we're already having to allocate certain vineyards because there's so much demand.
That's incredible. Hey, Michael, thank you.
Sure.
Michael Brill is creator of Crush Pad in San Francisco. For more information, you can go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from Britain's publication, The Economist. With packaging materials in short supply, people may have to resort to eating fresh food. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. You'll also find details on our spring trip to Italy on that very same website. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.